Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets. Hi, Carol the Coach here, and I am doing sex help with Carol the Coach. This is the only show on the internet through Blog Talk Radio that talks about sexual addiction, love addiction, and the fusing of other addictions with those two things. And I am so happy to be with you tonight. I know it's Monday. I hope you had a good weekend. Here in the Midwest, it was hot, hot, hot. Although we sure have not had hot. So we're very excited to be finally experiencing a little bit of summer. And I don't know where you're at, because what I do know to be true is that I've got 80,000 listeners across the world, across the globe. And that is one of the beautiful things about this show, that you may listen or you may not tonight live, but if you don't, you go to iTunes, you download the show, and if you subscribe to my podcast, hey, that means that you automatically get all my shows. You know, I have about 68 shows that I have recorded. And my transcriptionist, who is wonderful, said, hey, Carol, I think you've had about 60 shows. Happy anniversary. Well, there is no doubt that I may not have had 67 live shows. I may have played a few replays. You know, New Year's fell on Monday. Always Memorial Day and Labor Day falls on Monday, and I take a break. It is so important to know work-life balance. So I really appreciate the time that you spend with me and love the fact that you're tuning in and telling people about it. And I suspect that's in the 12-step community, because this is an issue that is not talked about much. You don't talk about it in the locker room. You don't talk about it much at the water cooler, but you do talk about it where it feels safe, and that usually is here on the show or in 12-step groups with good mental health therapists, or even with your pastor or priest, or the person that you spend some time with spiritually relating to. So I am, again, feeling very honored that I'm part of that group. Now, tonight, we have a really interesting show. It is not specifically, it is not tied in specifically to sexual addiction, but no doubt it has everything to do with sexual addiction. And, you know, I had a man contact me by the name of Dan Morris, and he is actually working with men to develop more of a connection. You know, he realizes that men have had to play that very masculine mindset where there's a lot of power and control and, you know, there's a hierarchy and really a denial of emotions and basically there are safety survival skills that he says most men have been taught or indoctrinated into as a child, and he wants to see that change. So he, one of the things he says is that men in recovery, you know, sex addicts must learn to depend on each other, and that this is a primary struggle in recovery. When men fail to gain recovery, it often can be tracked back to failure to form precious connections with other men. And, boy, I know that to be true. You hear me talk about it week in, week out, that, you know, my therapeutic men's group, they are there for each other. They very kindly but assertively confront each other when they see that somebody's not working a program. They, you know, it's the old spotted if you got it. They so often can spot situations that really, when identified, are the key to getting healthy. And so Dan is a man that absolutely believes that there is a general failure to bond and the addict can't belong to fellowship unless he works through that. There is no recovery without belonging to the fellowship. So we're going to be talking with him tonight about the challenges and the difficulties in forming these deep connections. If you want to talk to us, our number is 646-595-3284. And feel free to contact us at any point to talk about, you know, why it can be so difficult for men to really form relationships. And I buy into the stereotype. Not only do I buy into it, I tell men and women, hey, it's typically women that are the relationship builders. And I've certainly seen a shift, and I see men doing this more and more and more. But, you know, ultimately, it has been women's roles because, you know, they raised the kids. Well, Dan and I would both say, hey, it is time for a change. And it can be accomplished if given permission. So that's what this show's about all tonight, is giving permission to form those connections that are absolutely imperative in 12-step recovery. And, you know, last week we had another Dan on talking about what it was going to take to work through his love addiction. I can't emphasize enough that both sexual addiction and love addiction typically start out in childhood, early childhood, childhood that you may not even remember. Talked with a man tonight who said that his sibling told him that, you know, his sisters who reported molest by their older brother, well, he knew that that occurred, but it wasn't until he got into recovery that he found out that in actuality, his brother had said that he, too, was in a situation where he was with his sisters and, unfortunately, naked. And even though he can't remember being traumatized, he suspects that more than likely he was molested, too, and that this may be at the root of his fixation and his compulsivity to sex addiction. And if you listen to the show, you know that sexual compulsivity, hypersexuality, and or sex addiction oftentimes occurs when there's been major traumas or even little t traumas in childhood. You know, if you had an unavailable parent, then more than likely you learned how to fend for yourself. And what we know is that if you had to learn how to fend for yourself, you weren't getting your immediate needs met. And let's face it, as a child, that is what is supposed to happen. You're supposed to get your needs met. And if that hasn't happened, then I got to tell you, oftentimes, more often times than not, you will find ways of either medicating the pain or meeting those needs in inappropriate ways. And that's why it's always so important to do your family of origin work. And I know I've got a lot of my clients right now doing their sexual addiction and love addiction timelines. Now, what does that mean? That means that they are going through their childhood from birth on up, and they're looking at not only the events that occurred in their life, but the traumas that happened in their family. You know, maybe dad went to jail, or maybe mom and dad got a separation, or sister got pregnant, or, you know, somebody got in trouble and went to jail. These kind of traumas can really affect the upbringing of kids. And it can drive you to finding different ways of meeting your needs. That might be overeating. It could be overspending. It could be all sorts of things. And what we see is that many times that's played out sexually. And when it's played out sexually, understandably, that's something that most people don't get help with. And if they don't get help, then it progresses. And if it progresses with too much fervor, well, then what happens is before you know it, they are dealing with an addiction that is uncontrollable without the support of a good therapist and or a 12-step group and or a sponsor and or a lot of bibliotherapy. So that's what we hope to accomplish with this show, Sex, Love, and Relationships. This is a show that teaches strength, hope, and recovery when you're working a program that truly works. And I just thank Patrick Carnes and the whole ITAP community, the SASH community, Gentle Path Press, those organizations that have 100% designated and their life to making the lives of people that have addictions, making their lives easier. Okay, so now I told you we are going to have Dan Morris on the show. He actually does supervise certified sexual addiction therapists, and he gets them to the point where they actually can get their certification. So this man knows what he's talking about. And, you know, one of the things that I love is that he really works diligently at promoting good, healthy connections. And you know what? I think that's what life, that is what life is about. I have no doubt that it's not just about how much money you make or where you work or what car you drive. It is also about being able to form relationships that are long-lasting and genuine and authentic. So I'm really looking forward to what Dan has to say, because clearly he believes that a lot of men live by the rules. If you're hurt, you must be weak. If you're weak, you probably show hurt. And if you are afraid of being weak, you fear being hurt. If you fear, it means you are weak, and your fear will be hurt and shunned. So what do men do in that situation? Well, they do that thing that so many addicts do. They don't talk, trust, or feel. And his contingency is that sex addicts typically show nothing of themselves because they don't trust enough to be authentic or real. And so if that sounds like you, you're going to want to stay tuned to the show to figure out, okay, is it me? And if so, what do I need to do to improve my life and to work through the pain that I experienced probably in childhood and certainly as an adolescent and early adult? So I am really looking forward to that. Now let me just share with you a little bit about what I know to be true. You know, the men and women that work on themselves and work through this process addiction called sexual addiction are truly some of the finest people in the world. You know, their intent is A, to form relationships, and B, to take risks, to share vulnerabilities, and to defer to the people in their life that they most admire and love, which is usually their partner. And let's face it, addiction is known as a very selfish, self-absorbed situation where the addict only thinks of himself or herself. So what do you do when you are an addict and you've got this horrible addiction? Well, you do more of the same. You figure out how you can medicate using that addiction and what you need to do to maintain it. And that's what keeps you in that cycle of addiction. You know, so oftentimes Patrick Carnes and other people have talked about the cycle of addiction definitely starts with, anywhere in the cycle, but typically it starts with a preoccupation, you know, something that some seed that's planted in your mind, and then with that preoccupation occur some ritualizations. And what I mean by that is the ritual is that more oftentimes than not, you create a situation that helps to excite you throughout the situation. And then after you get through the ritualization, you get into the sexual compulsive behavior. And once you have gotten into the sexual compulsive behavior, well, then what you do more often than not is feel the deep-seated feelings of shame and remorse. And when you do that, wow, that's when very clearly you find that, wow, more often than not, you are in so much difficulty. You don't know what to do to get out of that cycle. So I'm going to do a commercial, and then I will be back with you in just a few minutes.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people. Every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
You know, that is the big question. Do you want to change that about yourself? So continue to listen to the show, and we will clearly let you know what it is that you need to do to improve your life, because this is a very tough disorder, and it takes a community to change it. It takes a good therapist, it takes a sponsor, it takes 12-step fellowship, and it takes experts in the field. And we have an expert in the field right now. I welcome Dan Morris. He is a licensed clinical social worker, and as I indicated before, he's a certified sexual addictions therapist, as well as a supervisor. So Dan, thank you for being on the show.
Hi, Carol. Good evening. It's great to be here on your show.
Yes, it seems like you have made it your mission to help men and women, but specifically men, feel comfortable connecting with each other in fellowship. Can I ask you, how did you decide that this was an important issue that addicts needed to know about?
Well, I began thinking about this way before I was a therapist, way back when I was a teenager. Then I began to notice, probably around the time I was 15, that my father, who I liked, we had a nice relationship. Actually, he was a terrific father in many ways, but he had absolutely no friends. None that I could see. He had people he would contact. Somebody would come over every once in a while, but the person he was mostly connected to was my mother. And I would ask him about that, and he would just sort of say, well, your mother and I are friends. I guess that's all I need. And I thought that was unfortunate. I had lots of friends. I had buddies. I think I was fortunate as a teen. I had lots of buddies from high school. But then as I grew into adulthood, I began to see how that happened to other people, and then I got married, and then it began to be more difficult to keep friends. And I saw that women had a greater, more in-depth friendship network than I had. At past the 20s, the buddying up of friends, it was more difficult. And then I got involved with men's network in my late 20s. The men's network or men's movement back in the late 70s, early 80s. And that's when I began to learn about how men are cut off from having decent, connected, better than just good friends. I mean, really good friends. And that's difficult, I think, for men to do. And that was way back in the, how long ago is that, about 33 years ago, 35, my math stinks, 35
now,
years ago?
Was that men's movement, the warrior movement?
Actually, it was not. I learned about the work that I want to talk a little bit about today from a guy named Charlie Kreiner. So it was before the Warriors Network with Robert Bly.
Right. Well, yes, you do go back a long way. So you intuitively knew that men did not have enough support. The buddy system, the relationships, that was not they didn't have access to that. They either relied on themselves or they relied on their partners.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And you know where it goes when you just rely on yourself. Talking to, your best friend, but that best friend may not be giving you the best advice all the time.
Exactly. So then,
and also maybe you're depending way too much on women. How about that?
Oh, I 100% agree. I think you got to spread that wealth. You've got to have support in all sorts of different areas. So that's how you first began to know that something was wrong in relationships between men. And you said that was the mid to late 80s.
Right. Actually, I started in the late 70s.
Okay.
And I started going to men's workshops. We were going to these workshops where we paid attention, close attention to the difficulties men face in connecting with one another. The men shut down. So I went to a wedding. You want to hear about this? A little,
absolutely.
On Friday. No, Saturday night. I went to a wedding. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And at the wedding, you know, kind of got around time for dancing, and the women started dancing with each other, and the guys sort of faded back. And I heard a rumor about this one guy through his wife saying, well, I used to dance with him, and then he eventually just told me that he hated dancing, hated it. And a little bit later, out on the dance floor, a 6 or 7-year-old flew out on the dance floor. He started bopping around and dancing wildly, and everybody watched him, and people were enjoying him, and he just kept going with wild abandon. There were no fears, and he just kept going, and guys were enjoying it, the women were enjoying it, and I thought to myself, what happens between the age of 6 and 7? And 28 or 30 or 35 or 45. So
what do
what
you
happens?
Think happens?
Well, yeah. I think locker room physics happens.
Okay.
Yeah. So locker room physics. What is that? Locker room physics is the experience men have as they grow into manhood and are equated, weighed and measured in terms of strength, prestige, power, force, size, looks, and the things that are really maybe really critically important that are less valued. You know, the less visible things of someone, like, you know, their ability to appreciate birds in flight. You don't hear guys talk about their enjoyment of birds in flight a whole lot when they get to a party, do you?
No, you don't.
Maybe they
Never.
Do if they're bird lovers. Right. Guys, what do guys talk about when they get to parties?
Oh, they talk about guns. They talk about conquest, really. You know, things
work.
That they achieved.
Yeah, yeah. Things that they achieve, right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the conversation kind of winds down. And people stop thinking about, well, they forget, or they run into fears about what else to talk about. And a lot of guys start reporting on the difficulty in talking to one another. Well, I don't really have anything else to say to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think what really happens is that in order to keep conversations going between men have to find ways to begin to demonstrate interest in one another that goes mm-hmm. beyond just the stereotypical things like, what did you do at work? So that people begin to share their stories more in earnest. But as a rule, men don't know that other men are particularly interested in the various aspects of their life stories. And I guess that's because men don't demonstrate that interest in general until they have the opportunity to begin to share with one another more in depth. And that takes quite a bit of doing. A lot of guys don't find their ways to those kind of situations.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking two things. I'm thinking,
yeah.
Obviously you did become aware. You had insight and have made it your mission to help men feel more comfortable with this. And I'm also thinking about the fact that you did join a support network of men that helped you to explore who you were and your authenticity and transparency, as well as each man in the group. So, A, how did you get to your own personal group? And B, how can you encourage men to do the same?
Okay. Well, I think I was fortunate, really. And maybe I was predisposed. I'm not really sure. I think part of it was that I had the good fortune to live in a very stable neighborhood, and I had a lot of buddies. And a lot of people, I find, don't have that kind of situation, grow up feeling pretty isolated as adolescents, have more difficulty going into adulthood, finding friends and keeping them.
Maybe part of it had to do with your neighborhood and the fact that there were plenty of boys, males, available.
Yeah, right from grade school through to high school. A couple guys I'm still in touch with.
But I guess
I was lucky also, perhaps it had to do with just particular interests and a sensitivity I had to people that I guess it got supported by my parents, and then I lucked out. I did things that put me in contact with people where there was an exploration of humanity and deeper issues that were all about what makes us human beings. And I found the men's work that really helped me out. But I got to tell you something. You know, I did all that stuff way back in the 80s, 90s. And what I've learned is that it's very easy for men, very, very easy, and I think this is true about myself, to lose it, to let these relationships stray. If I'm not working hard on maintaining the relationships, they don't develop. And so you have to be in a situation where the relationships develop. So I decided to create that here at the center that we work at here.
And that's
fortunate.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So we started, myself and my colleague and long-term friend, Bob Meadows, started Carriage House Psychotherapy, which is located in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
And we began doing treatment for people with sex addictions back in the early 90s, and the program developed once I got training at ITAP to become a CSAT. Mm-hmm. So the work has progressed and it's become more sophisticated. But we used to do terrific groups for guys that were sort of based on what he and I had learned way back when. I actually met him in the late 70s. And we had a way of working that was terrific for guys. They had great experiences in the group where they would, you know, let down, they'd have feelings, they would share something a lot more profound than what they usually shared in their day-to-day lives with other men. But then they would go out the very next day and act out their sexual addiction. And I think what I learned was that we weren't doing enough. For one thing, and just to talk about sex addiction for a minute.
Yeah, please.
Okay. It wasn't enough for men to have great relationships in group. Those relationships did not translate into group, into making deeper connections outside a group. So I think it was, we provided a wonderful, safe environment, and we supported people to do stuff, and they stayed in the group for 1 to 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these guys went on to forming relationships outside, but a lot of people did not. So what I've learned is that the 12-step world actually can be a marvelous opportunity for people with addictions to go get support in an ongoing way. But they don't necessarily feel very satisfying to guys initially because the way they're structured in part. and you have to ask for help. Well,
so that's what you mean by the way they're structured, because you have to ask for help?
You do. You have to go there and say, I've got a problem. I've got a real significant problem, and I need help with this. And you just can't ask once. You have to ask over and over. And you learn in these situations, and we start the ball rolling here at Kavod. Did I say anything about Kavod?
No, not yet.
Kavod. Yeah, Kavod is the sex addiction program here at Carriage House.
Okay.
Kavod, K-A-V-O-D. And
okay.
So we start the ball rolling. They go to the 12-step world. They come back here, and they stay in a process where they learn to connect with what's going on inside. And one of the things that I ask people over and over and over is, do you have one man in your life who knows everything about you?
Mm-hmm.
And you know what most guys say?
Absolutely not. They keep
no
to themselves.
Way, right.
Yeah.
No way am I going to tell anybody about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So all along the way, all the circumstances of growing up mitigate against forming close, intimate, non-sexual relationships with other men. But if you don't have them, you don't have recovery ultimately, because you have to build long-term, enduring relationships, because addiction is chronic, and you have to have people that you can be very open with about all your darkness.
That makes all the sense in the world. And although I do think that there are people all over, you know, it's not just a male thing. It's certainly more oftentimes a male thing. Were you lucky enough to get to see Brené Brown at the ITAP conference?
Yeah, I did see her.
See, I did not, but I have seen her and read her before. And you know, she talks about vulnerability is the key to not only life, but authenticity and transparency in your own world. And so it makes so much sense that you say you're an encourager for men to have the courage to admit that they need some help and to need other people and to get out of that kind of machismo or macho role that they've been instilled to play.
Right,
now,
exactly.
Where do you think that came from, that conditioning to play the male macho role?
Well, I'm not a sociologist. I can guess that the roles evolved over the last 2,000-3,000 years of civilization, the development of Western civilization, I think, with men being trained to be warriors and workers, primarily. So, did you ever see the movie The 300?
No.
It's Carol?
Tell me about it.
No, it came out about, I don't know, 5 years ago, something like that. It's all digitally constructed. And it talks about the Spartans and the development, or the war against, what was it, the Persians at Thermopylae? Is that the right way to say it? Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And 300 guys held off thousands, you know, this massive army, and they sacrificed themselves for the greater good of the society. And they, in the movie, there's a scene where they show how Spartan soldiers are raised, and I thought it was instructive. It's a movie, maybe there's plenty of artistic license, but it rang true in many ways for me personally. And what happens is they rip the boys away from their mothers very early in their lives. You know, about the same time this boy who was dancing at the, same age as the boy who was dancing at the wedding, I'd say, six, seven, eight. And they take him and they beat him up. And they subject them to abuse, physical abuse, and they teach him how to fight or be hurt. And it goes on for years. this fighting. And that, so they're in the company of males, and in this, so it's a sequence of takes or scenes, and at the end, what you see is this boy who's hating and bleeding and having, you know, being punched over and over, and there he is, the warrior. I will sacrifice myself. And actually, what it looks like is he's being trained to be a bully.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what happens to a lot of guys, all of us. If you, I mean, if the people who are listening now, all of your listening audience, all you men out there, were to ask other men, or to ask, if you're sitting around with other men, ask how many of you were actually hit by another male growing up. Could have been your brother, could have been your father, was a neighborhood bully. And I'm talking about the experience here in the United States, so I'm sure, I don't want to overgeneralize and say this is true world round.
Right.
But boys undergo systematic traumatization in their connections with other males over and over. If they're not strong enough, then they're slotted for no man's land. Eventually, what I call no man's land, which is you're shunted off. Yeah.
It's like they're being punished, obviously, for not having that instinct to fight and to bully until they become that
instinct, way. Yeah. Yeah, you have to fight to protect yourself, or you're labeled weak or effeminate, and you know where that goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you get slotted at the bottom of the caste system, which for a lot of people at this particular time in history, is you're labeled gay, and if you talk to males who grew up as gay, they have a horrendous experience. Where they faced abuse and the threat of violence fairly regularly in their lives. So nobody wants to, guys don't want to be targeted as gay. So that's effeminate and weak. And so
you take on
roles. Yeah.
PowerPoint presentation towards the end, I mean, the three pictures, maybe second to the last, was, you know, of men with their arms around each other, not in embrace, but as in camaraderie and just buddyhood. And it was so refreshing to see that. But you're right. We do not project that image. We don't socialize men to feel that way. It's almost seen as if, well, if that's happening, they must be gay.
Well, so in public or in private, you don't allow yourself to get comforted by men physically. Like, there's no whole hand-holding. I was just talking to somebody about that this morning, and I suggested that. I asked him if he, you know, who in group did he feel supported by and comforted by, and of course he would never have any kind of physical contact with them, because that's extraordinarily threatening. It's not non-sexual contact, you know, the kind of, I think guys allow themselves pats on the shoulders and maybe a slap alongside the head or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
but
clearly, you know, you're showing why we have an identity crisis for men, where they don't feel like they can show their weakness or show their inadequacies or show their desire to be in partnership with other guys, you know.
Right.
But you have found that the 12-step fellowship program really does provide that.
It can. There's the potential for that happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But people have to eventually address their deeper fears in connecting with one another. Mm-hmm. I find that to be really important. Otherwise, everything will stay more or less at the surface, and then people probably will not share they're acting out because of the level of shame that goes with that. They won't share the deeply shameful things, the darker sides inside.
Can you give us some examples of some darker sides, some shame that you believe men don't feel comfortable sharing?
Well, you know, there's quite a broad range. So just, you know, non-sexual kinds of issues. How well did you do in school? You know, where did you get good grades? What was your family like? What was Dad like? Did he have a good job, a not so great job? Was Dad somebody you were proud of or not proud of? Or did you feel supported or not supported by him? Talking about the experiences of being hurt by it, as you grew up, just the, I mean, like if you talk to guys, a lot of guys will talk about horrendous experiences growing up, like being picked on by other kids or isolated, and they won't talk about that stuff until they really sense that you're truly interested in them as a person, which in itself is remarkable, because I don't think guys really trust that other men have a deep, abiding interest in them. I, you know, I'm sure there are people out there saying I'm overgeneralizing, but I see that over and over. Okay, so that's, then you move into the more secretive parts of people's lives. You know, the kind of things that they do they're not proud of, stealing and cheating. You know, the addictions that are part of their lives, the abusiveness that has gone on in their lives, they don't share that because people want to present an image of themselves as being fine, upstanding people. But actually, probably all of us, right, have done things that we're not proud of and have hurt people, and we don't share it. There's all the sexual stuff that people are out there doing. And you, I heard you say, you said it at the beginning, correct, that sex addiction is pervasive, far more than I think people would want to admit.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I
was interesting,
yeah,
because when I said, can you give me some examples, the first thing you said was, well, you know, I don't know how you said it, but you basically said, okay, I'll give you some examples that are not sexually based. And I thought, boy, when I'm talking with men, even more so than women, for women it tends to be a little bit later in their development, but when I'm talking to men, a lot of men experiment with each other early in their development.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I see that as normal.
A lot of guys.
But yet,
yes,
there's so much shame and guilt associated with it that I'm not so sure, Dan, that it doesn't create what I would call a reaction formation that keeps them separate from their buddies, you know, as they get older, because they do feel so much internalized shame about that. And yet,
absolutely,
I see that as normal sexual development. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder if your listening audience knows what reaction formation means. I think it's a
probably
great example.
Yeah, that's
should
a good idea. Reaction formation is a defense mechanism for the listening audience, whereby if you have a feeling about something, then you find it so distasteful that you either project it onto somebody, and so you want to stay away from them, or you just avoid the relationship in general because it is not who you feel like you want to be. And so what I'm really saying is that boys spend time in their development sexually playing with each other, you know, whether that's they masturbate each other, they touch each other, they have contests in terms
they
of how far they
fantasize about it.
Yeah, and that they often feel so much guilt about something that was normal and natural and healthy that they then end up staying away from their buddies as they get older. They don't really form those intimate bonds because they're too afraid of A, being gay, or B, their own feelings of shame and guilt about having done it in the first place, because more often than not, they were shamed. You know, somebody caught them, somebody heard about it, and somebody made them feel bad about something that initially was very natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You, and people tell you those stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Sometimes it's the scoutmaster who discovers kids, you know, doing that. And more often than not, they, you know, kids get shamed for it. Nobody says anything like, okay, or just notices but doesn't make any kind of deal about it and just goes on about it. But there's tremendous fear about kids and their sexuality, and nobody knows how to address that. You know, normal sexuality. And you know, it's difficult. You want to digress a little?
Yeah, please.
Just a touch.
We've got 9 minutes. Go ahead, digress.
9 minutes. Okay. Well, like I'm a parent, right? And for the life of me, when my kids were little, they did not want to hear me talk about sex with them. That was not a topic for them to want to address. And so I, you know, stopped. Now, I remember my father sharing or beginning to give me the talk, right? It was the last thing I wanted to hear from him. And I doubt my experience is all that rare. What do you think?
Oh, 100%. I definitely don't think your experience is that rare. And clearly, you know, I was just talking, actually, now this is the opposite of what we're referencing, but I was just talking to a dad today, an addict, whose daughter was masturbating early, and he caught her, and she said three things. She said, I can't stop, and of course that triggered all sorts of red flags for him. What do you mean? She's 9 years old, she can't stop. And I said, you know what, that's normal. And B, she's gone through her parents getting a divorce and a move and all sorts of things that may mean she needs to self-soothe. And touching yourself, whether it's sucking your thumb, stroking your hair, touching your genitals, are all very, very normal ways of self-soothing. That can't stop may mean I'm really anxious and I don't know what to do about my anxiety. So, you know, I really encourage Dad to see if Mom, they're divorced, and he could take her to a therapist just to go for a good, healthy assessment to make sure she's managing her stress, that it's not a sexual issue. It's more than likely an anxiety or a stress issue. And I think this happens to boys all the time. You know, they're playing around. They're having fun. They're having contests, all sorts of things. And they either get villainized about it or, for whatever reason, they, you know, because nobody talks to them about sex, they feel bad about it.
Well, two trends come together at the same time pretty much, which is adolescence and all the issues about developing into a male that guys have to try to figure out, and an emerging sexual being.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sexual feelings get mixed up with all kinds of other experiences. And nobody to talk to about it. Nobody.
You're somebody that's doing a very good job of encouraging men to talk with you and with each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
I was just going to say.
Suggestions?
I just wondered if our listening audience would like to email you or would like to look at a website or hear more about your clinic. Would you give them some websites or some phone numbers so that they have that information?
Sure. Phone number here in the United States is 585-546-5180. We're at kavodrecovery.com, kavodrecovery.com. That's where we are on the web. I just started a blog, so you'll see a lot of what we've been talking about here, and I'll keep writing. If you want to write in, email me at dmorris, D and Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, at rpa.net, robertpaulallen.net, D. Morris at rpa.net. If you want to send your stories to me, send them, and I'll probably edit, and the ones that I think are really appropriate and very useful, I'll put into the blog. If you'd like, I did this years ago and got a tremendous amount of response from people. Some thoughts about how to manage your isolation if you're isolated. Can we do that before we go?
Absolutely. Got about a minute
okay.
left.
I can do this. 1 minute. All right. So imagine
you really had three,
not...
but I'm keeping you at a one so that we can go three. Continue.
Okay. All right, because I'll probably talk too long.
You'll probably go five.
So, guys, just imagine that you're not alone. You probably think that you're the only person who's shy, embarrassed easily, doesn't know what to say or how to say it. But probably 8 out of every 10 guys feels more or less like you do. Maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't know. But a lot of people just feel totally inept and don't know how to say that. But you have to have a place where you can begin to talk. And it can't be loud and noisy. You have to find people in a place who are willing to just sit down for a period of time, which means you really, if there are people in your life that you like, or you join a men's group of some sort, there are a lot of different kinds of men's groups. Churches are doing men's groups now. Churches all over the United States are doing this. They're creating an environment for men to do healing instead of sending men away. Churches, temples, mosques. Yeah, you have to find people who are interested in beginning a process with you, and then you stay with it for the rest of your life. I like the way Pat Carnes puts this. He says this. He says, basically, you have to think well, and you have to have people who you can tell everything to in your life. And then the cute phrase he comes up with is you have to hold on to your frontal lobes with both hands. You remember that one, Carol?
Absolutely.
Have you heard that?
Absolutely. It was one of my favorite things he ever said.
Exactly. Frontal lobes with both your hands. You have to stay with it. You have to devote time and energy and get support to work through difficulties. There will be difficulties, no doubt. Okay, how are we time-wise?
Well, we are just about wrapping up. So I just have to tell you that really good advice, Dan, and I can tell that you're a man's man. You want men to have those precious connections because it really is the soulfulness of life. And I so thank you for adding your information to the show. Can't thank you enough.
Thank you for having me on the show, Carol. I enjoyed myself. It was nice talking with you. I wondered what your voice would sound like. And so I've been staring at your picture here on my computer, and it feels like I've been talking right to you all night long here. So nice meeting you.
Oh, you too. And we'll catch up at the next conference. You have a great week, and thanks again.
Excellent. All right. Okay. Good night.
Good night. Well, that was
bye-bye.
Dan Morris, and obviously he has a lot to offer. Hey, we're at the end of our show. So as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And next week we're going to have a repeat because I am actually bonding with 16 women at our lake place. So, you know, just more about bonding and socializing and supporting and caring and loving and all that stuff. Thanks so much for being a part of the show, and we'll catch you live in 2 weeks. Have a great week, and make it real. You're listening to Carol the Coach, and this is Sex Help, Strength, Hope, and Recovery.